What is up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. I'm recording this on Friday, February 7th, the day after the trade deadline. And this was probably the craziest trade deadline in recent memory. I mean, aside from the Luka Doncic stuff, we saw some really big names move: De'Aaron Fox, Jimmy Butler. We had the Bucks getting aggressive, moving off a legend of their team in Chris Middleton. A lot of other fringe moves. Tons of rumors around Kevin Durant and if he was going to be moved, and the Phoenix Suns and whatever their plan is moving forward. But I'm going to talk all things trade deadline here. We're going to go through all of the bigger moves. I'm probably not going to get to a lot of the smaller ones just because of how many big names we had moved. I don't want to make this thing too long for you guys. But with that being said, let's go ahead and get right into it. So starting off, De'Aaron Fox being shipped out to San Antonio after reports came out earlier about a week ago that he was ready to move on and he did not intend on re-signing in Sacramento. And so the Kings were prepared to recoup whatever value they could for him before, you know, he eventually did re-sign elsewhere if they held on to him. So in this deal, the Spurs got De'Aaron Fox and Jordan McLaughlin. The Kings acquired Zach LaVine from the Bulls, as well as Sidy Sissoko, who was later rerouted a couple times and then I think cut. So that was more of just a filler there. But then they got 3 second-round picks, a 2031 first coming from Minnesota, unprotected, a 27 first coming from San Antonio, unprotected, and then a 2025 first from Charlotte, which is top 14 protected for this year. Then the Bulls, the third team to help facilitate this, they took on the salaries of Trey Jones, Kevin Huerter, Zach Collins, and then from San Antonio, they got back their own 2025 first round pick, which they sent out to the Spurs back when they signed and traded for DeMar DeRozan a few years ago. So the Bulls feel can actually maybe try to tank this year if they decide to go that route and they would actually have their pick. But for this deal, on the Spurs side of things, I think they did really, really well here for a number of reasons. I mean, I think just looking at the value and what they had to send out, they didn't have to trade Devin Vassell. They didn't have to trade Stephon Castle. They didn't have to trade Jeremy Sohan. I mean, this was a picks-based deal rather than a player-based deal, which I think made a lot of sense for them because they have a bevy of picks available to deal out, not only their own, but they have a lot of other teams as well. And even after this deal, they have a ton of picks still. So this didn't limit their flexibility at all. And I think Fox to San Antonio always made the most sense just across the board. It was obviously his preferred destination, which had been reported on. And it just made sense not only for on-court, but also off the court. For the on-court piece of this, Fox is a really good player. I mean, he's not in the all-NBA type discussion. He's not even a bona fide perennial all-star guy, but he's still very, very good. He's a walking 25-6-4 on pretty good shooting from the field. He's been highly impactful over the past few seasons for Sacramento, and he's going to bring shot creation. He's going to bring a little bit of extra pace to this team, which I think they could really benefit from offensively. In particular, he's going to bring a guy that gets downhill, attacks the basket, a guy to take pressure off Wemby, the eventual long-term pick and roll partner with Wembanyama once Chris Paul eventually moves on. I know that they started them together in the previous game, so we'll see if they continue that or not, but they desperately needed another reliable offensive player. And he is more than capable of that next to Wembanyama, especially because was it working with him as the number one option in Sacramento? Not really, but moving to clear number two, especially as Wembanyama continues to improve and eventually probably ends up in the top five, if not best player in the world discussion, they're going to be contenders with Fox and Wemby as long as they have some semblance of a decent supporting cast, which they have some of now. I still think the Spurs roster as a whole around these guys is pretty weak, but I like where they're at now a lot better, adding Fox and moving kind of everybody else, like especially a Devin Vassell down in the pecking order where he doesn't have to be the number two, but instead is more of a tertiary option for them on the offensive end, which I think is kind of, that's the destiny that he was always set out to have, a guy like him. But by far, my favorite reason for why San Antonio was just the best fit for this and why I love this for the Spurs is because this doesn't have to be the all-in move that the Spurs make, but it's a move that they make. You know, a lot of the other teams contending for Fox, they were going to have to basically get rid of all of the remaining assets they had. Like Miami, for example, was tied to him a little bit because him and Bam played in college together. But Miami, if they traded for Fox, all of their remaining first round picks would have been out the door. They also would have been pretty strapped cap wise because Bam's on a max contract. Hero's making over $30 million. Fox is about to get a max contract. Like that team, that was going to be what they had. And the Fox Hero Bam duo or trio, sorry, that is just, that's the team moving forward. There's no flexibility to add around that. Whereas San Antonio, they still have most of their own first round picks, as well as three extremely valuable Atlanta Hawks picks over the next 3 years that are fully unprotected. And then they kept all of the players I already mentioned. And so they have so much flexibility and optionality to add around this roster. They could consolidate Vassell with a couple of those picks and a couple other fillers and get another legitimate star to add to Wemby and Fox to make sort of a big three of sorts. Or they could decide that hasn't worked in the NBA recently. Instead, let's consolidate some of these picks into a bunch of just super high level role players and build just around depth and defense around these two guys. And so one, they've got time to figure this out because Wemby is still so ridiculously young and you want to see how they mesh a little bit. But they, again, they are set up so well. And so I think Fox, admittedly, I'm not the biggest Fox guy. I'll say that. I mean, his skill set, I think what I want out of star point guards are guys that lean a little bit on the pass first side, that are really high level playmakers for others, and guys that have super reliable jump shots. And Fox doesn't really check any of those boxes, but he's obviously super unique still. And so for a lot of teams to bring him in and give him a max contract, I would have been very hesitant. I would have not liked this deal for Miami. I would have not liked this deal for most other teams that were trading for Fox because, again, I think Fox has a ceiling as a player. But because of the flexibility that San Antonio has, because he will never have to be the number one option on this team or the best player because of how just great Wemby's going to be, it's just it alleviates all of the concerns that I would have had with Fox. So that's why I love this deal for San Antonio, not only because of what they gave up or didn't have to give up, but also just the fit on the organization, not even just on the team, but just overall. So love this deal for San Antonio across the board. On the Kings side of things, you know, as I mentioned, that first round picks, the Charlotte one, is going to not convey, and it turns into 2 second round picks. So the 3 firsts, 3 seconds is a little deceiving. It's really 2 firsts and 5 seconds. And obviously they get Zach LaVine in this deal as well. But so I've gone back and forth on this. My first initial reaction was that I thought Sacramento did really well here because, I mean, I think 3 firsts and LaVine on paper is really good value for Fox. But, you know, as you start to look at the picks and one of them is not a real first round pick. And then you look at like the 2027 Spurs pick, that's probably not going to be super valuable down the road. The Spurs will be in playoff contention. That could even be in the 20s by the time that conveys. And then you look at all the other picks San Antonio had, the Hawks picks, like how could they not get one of the Hawks picks? The Kings also have sent out a swap in 2031, I believe, to the Spurs previously to help them get DeRozan. Like they could have got their swap back. Like there's just more valuable picks that I probably would have wanted to get if I was Sacramento. But, you know, it's not a terrible return because I still think LaVine is a really good player. I mean, he's had a tremendous bounce back season this year, shooting well over 50% from the field, well over 40% from three. He's still a 20 to 25 point per game scoring guy. And it might sound a little crazy, but I think that there's not an insane drop off from De'Aaron Fox to Zach LaVine. I know Fox is a better, more accomplished player at this point, but I mean, they're both score first guards, can get you 25 a night, and LaVine's a little bit more efficient doing so. I know he's less of a ball handler and creator, more of an off ball. I mean, he can do some on ball stuff, but he's not going to run and initiate your offense as much as a Fox will do. But the point is, like, I don't think they're both kind of fringe all-star guys to me. And I think LaVine gets the bad rep and people are scared off by him because of the contract and the injuries and all of that. But at his peak, LaVine's been a really good player. He's a multi-time all-star and actually has more all-star appearances than Fox does. So I think just given how good Levine's been this year, and I actually think that his fit on this team might be even a little bit of a better fit, which sounds kind of crazy because I know Fox is the better player. Don't get me wrong, but Sacramento needs shooting and Levine's a much better shooter than Fox. I think that they want to run their offense through Sabonis anyway, which Levine's a little better playing through other players and off ball versus Fox, who needs the ball in his hands to be a little bit more effective. And so I think that the Kings, from a roster standpoint, don't lose a ton. I'm kind of interested to see how the Malik Monk point guard experience works, but they've got good players. They're still not close to contending. They're still probably going to miss the playoffs, but I don't feel any differently about their on-court product than I did before this deal. I thought they were probably a back-end play-in team, not going to make the playoffs, and I feel the same way now. But now they have more assets and Levine, who at least might want to be there more than Fox did, and they've got him locked up for a little bit more time. So I think all in all, decent trade for the Kings. I think it leaves a little bit to be desired because you didn't get those picks, or just better picks, and you didn't get any of the young players from San Antonio. But I think Levine's a nice consolation prize, and at least they did pick up some assets along the way. So given the lack of leverage they had, because Fox literally 1 year left could just walk away, and other teams were probably scared off because they knew he wanted San Antonio. So again, pretty good return overall, in my opinion, for the Kings. But ultimately, I don't feel that differently about the Kings than I did a week ago. On the Bulls side of things, they continue to baffle me a little bit. I find it hard to believe that they couldn't have gotten a better deal than this. I mean, the Levine trade rumors have been swirling for years. And even before he kind of had some bad injury plagued seasons, that it was always kind of talked about. So I'm sure they could have sold way higher back then. Then even during the injuries, it was talked about. And I don't blame them for holding on to him because I think the offers probably weren't great then. But he's having a great year this year. I mean, a 24 point per game scorer that's shooting 50, 40, 80 splits, basically, you'd think you could get more than just your own first round pick and fillers back. It just feels like they took all of the extra crap from this deal to help facilitate it. And they were just there along for the ride, you know? And I get they probably wanted to get their pick back from 2025, but, and I could maybe cut them some slack if this hadn't been a recurring trend for them. I mean, if you just look at where they've been over the past few seasons with what they've traded out and what they've gotten back, I mean, in total, trading out DeRozan, Caruso, and Levine, their entire net of those three guys getting traded out is Trey Jones, Kevin Huerter, Zach Collins, Chris Duarte, who they had to waive to make this deal happen. So he's not even there anymore. 2 second-round picks, Josh Giddey, and then their first-round pick that they sent out to get DeRozan in the first place. So if you just look at net, like the pick went out for DeRozan, came back for Levine. So it's really a net even there across the board. You didn't gain any additional value from trading these guys out. I've been a defender of the Giddey and Caruso trade. I think Giddey is a better player than Caruso, especially long-term. So I was okay with them not getting additional assets there. But I mean, to not get a single additional first round pick for trading out Levine and DeRozan, to get not even a semi-interesting player, Trey Jones on an expiring deal, Kevin Huerter is kind of like an overpaid contract that nobody would really want. Spurs fans were begging to get Zach Collins out of the building, and then they cut Duarte. So I don't really know what their plan is. They haven't been able to get decent value on any of the deals that they've made over the past few years. And they didn't trade Nikola Vucevic when he is pushing mid-30s and having maybe the best year of his career, legitimately. Like, now would be the ultimate time to sell high. If there weren't great offers, you know, you'd still send him out. I think Golden State probably would have given them at least a handful of second-round picks. Plus, I don't know if they're getting Kuminga, but it's like, could you get one first-round pick out of them? Then suddenly that's an asset that you picked up that you couldn't have gotten a first for Vucevic last year. And then to get one this year, that's a good sell high, you know? So I don't know what the offers were, but it just makes no sense. I don't know what their plan is. The quotes coming out are embarrassing, honestly, talking about how they don't need a star player to win. It's like, well, why are you wanting your pick back so badly if you're then not going to do a fire sale? It just, they have no direction. They don't know. They keep hinting that they want to compete, but then their decisions say otherwise, but then they don't want to bottom out. So they're all over the place. I don't like this deal for Chicago. I don't I continue to not like most things that Chicago does. I will say that. Then moving to the next big trade, Jimmy Butler was finally traded to the Golden State Warriors. And we talked about this probably way too much, but Jimmy Butler was dealt to the Warriors with 2 seconds. In return, the Heat got Andrew Wiggins, Davion Mitchell from Toronto, Kyle Anderson, a 2025 first round pick that is top 10 protected this year, then is top 10 protected next year, then will be unprotected if it doesn't convey until 2027. This deal got expanded where the Pistons ended up with Dennis Schroeder, Lindy Waters, second round pick. The Jazz got KJ Martin, Josh Richardson in 2 seconds. And then the Raptors got PJ Tucker, who has bounced around over the last couple of weeks, and a second round pick from Miami. And I'll just say that first off, fit aside, this is a great trade for Golden State from a value perspective, because Jimmy Butler is probably, first off, the best player they could have added. And second of all, it didn't cost them much at all. I mean, they'll miss some of what Wiggins does, but I'm not really sure there's anything Wiggins does that Butler doesn't do as well or better. I guess 3-point shooting. But Butler's proven that when the games are important, he can knock down shots from outside. And he just provides so much more than what Wiggins brings. But outside of that, I mean, Anderson, an expendable rotation piece, Schroeder, you know, he had not played close to the level he did in Brooklyn since getting to Golden State. And so I didn't love that fit anyway. That wasn't a big needle mover for me. But the fact that they were able to keep Kuminga, keep Brandon Pajemski, keep Moses Moody, keep Trayce Jackson-Davis, and then assuming their pick conveys this season, which I think it will because I don't foresee them falling into the top 10 in the draft, then they now have full control over every single pick except for 2030, which they sent out to Washington, I believe, in the Jordan Poole deal. But they've got their own 26, 27, 28, 29, and then 2031 pick fully intact. So they've maintained their flexibility. After this pick conveys, they can trade up to 3 first-round picks. They've still got all those young guys to move around. They still can make moves. Or if things don't work out, they're not totally messing up their future once Steph or Draymond or Jimmy Butler eventually roll off the books. But they will have a little bit of a window here because Jimmy Butler did sign a 2-year, $121 million extension as well. So Steph, Draymond, and Jimmy, their deals all line up to expire the same year. So they could totally reset with a completely new roster in 2 years, or they can continue to bring those guys back depending on where they're at. We'll see where those players even are in terms of their ability and health and if they're even considering retiring at that point. I mean, they're all pretty, pretty old at this point. But for on the court, I know on paper, it's not the best fit from a shooting and spacing perspective. I mean, in theory, their 5 best players on the court would be Steph, Kuminga, Butler, Draymond, and then probably Looney at the 5. But that is a tough spaced lineup. I mean, Kuminga, not a reliable outside shooter. Butler, not a reliable outside shooter, not really a willing shooter. Draymond has shot a lot better in the last few years, but still not a guy that you really trust to be a legitimate floor spacer. And then Looney's a non-factor as a shooter. So it's Steph and then 4 complete non-shooters. So to me, I think it makes most sense for Kuminga to come off the bench in this scenario and probably start Buddy Hield to give you that extra shooting, but even maybe sometimes Pajemski if you want a little bit more defense and playmaking, because he can knock it down from out there, even though he hasn't had a great shooting season overall compared to last season. But I think Butler is going to be highly, highly motivated. Every time he's been very motivated, he's just played the best basketball of his career. And I think that he is out to prove something. I think he felt disrespected from the Heat because they didn't want to extend him. And I think that the best version of Jimmy Butler is still a highly effective and impactful player, a top 15 to top 20 guy in the league, legitimately. And so I still think he's plenty good defensively. He's going to probably improve this team's defense overall just with his length and versatility out there on the perimeter. And he still plays hard on that end, unlike a lot of aging stars we have in the league. But then offensively, I've been saying this for a while, but they have desperately needed a better second option because Kuminga has just not been able to take that role, despite them probably wanting to transition him into that role on this team. Wiggins, you know, he's been very up and down over the last couple of years and is much better suited for a complementary tertiary or even 4th, 5th option on a team at this point in his career. And so Butler is immediately probably the best shot creator on the team. I mean, Steph obviously is elite, but he relies on Draymond and a lot of other guys to get him his looks. He obviously can create, but Butler is elite as a shot creator. And he's the only guy in this roster who's going to put consistent pressure on the rim now. Kuminga does that a little bit, but Butler, I mean, I said this on a previous pod I was on, among all players at his position, the number one player in terms of percentage of shots taken at the rim. So he gets to the basket. He gets to the free throw line. He is still a very good playmaker. So he's going to be able to get Steph his looks. When Draymond's not out there, he's going to be able to create his own looks. Like, it's just such more of a diversity on offense that they haven't had, and taking pressure off of Steph. And so just the things he's able to do with the ball in his hands, they now have three guys that I trust with the ball in their hand, adding Draymond in there as well as a facilitator and playmaker, which is not something I was able to say before. And so they've been so inconsistent, and all of it's been because of when Steph doesn't have a shot, they just can't win games. They didn't have guys that can step up. And I think he still has a lot left in the tank. This should, in theory, he should be super, super fresh, because he hasn't been playing games. I mean, he's been sitting at home just doing nothing. So I think that he is going to be super well-suited to come in and play some of the best basketball he's played over the last few years, maybe take the regular season a little bit more seriously. I think it's a good culture fit, assuming him and Draymond don't butt heads, but I think he's going to buy into their winning approach and putting winning above all else. I think that's kind of the way he operates as well. And so overall, I think this genuinely pushes Golden State up a notch in terms of how I view them as a playoff team and a contender. I think they've surpassed Phoenix, who's obviously been a mess and we'll get to later on. I think that they are clearly above Sacramento now. I think that I probably have them above Dallas. I still have major question marks about what they're going to look like with Luka no longer there and Anthony Davis in the fold. And so to me, they're kind of up in the tier with the Clippers as a team that could be the seven-ish seed. You know, they're obviously in a little bit of a hole. They'll have to climb up. But I mean, you go on a 3-4 game winning streak and you can jump two spots in the standings with how compact it is. And I think they're going to be a scary team come playoff time. I think that it's not going to be fun if you're a 1 or 2 seed having to see Steph Curry, a motivated Jimmy Butler, Draymond Green, Steve Kerr, and a decent supporting cast with some good depth and defense. So I love this deal for Golden State, especially because of the value that they got it for, a huge discount for a guy that could end up being a huge all-NBA level game changer for you. But I also think the fit is going to be better than people anticipate. I'm not too worried about the shooting just because he's going to bring so many other things to the table that it should be able to outweigh any concerns as far as their spacing on the court. And they're going to figure it out. They got three really good, really smart players alongside Steve Kerr, who's one of the greatest coaches of all time at this point. So, but on the Miami side, I don't really love this for them. I know they had basically zero leverage whatsoever. It was basically Phoenix offer or Golden State offer, and that's all you were going to get. KD was probably never realistic for them. Jimmy had basically scared off every other team, and there wasn't a lot of interest across the league. And I get it. And they really drew this thing out. But one first round pick that's probably going to be in the mid-teens, and Andrew Wiggins and some role player fillers is just not what you'd hope out of a guy in Jimmy Butler, who's carried his team to the finals twice over the past 5 seasons, been an all-NBA level player as recently as last year or the year before. And so I feel like they could have done better. And to be honest, I know they wanted to keep their cap flexibility and they didn't want to take on the Bradley Beal contract. And look at Phoenix. I get it. They're really strapped right now because of that. But I kind of feel like the Suns deal was better. I feel like that Beal, and if they were offering all 3 first round picks, and I don't know why they wouldn't have, considering how much it was reported they were strongly pushing for this. I feel like Beal and those 3 first round picks is better than 1 pick in Wiggins, in my opinion. I know there's more flexibility on that front, but look, Beal, he gets a lot of shit and people kind of associate him with his contract, which is fair if we're talking as an asset, but he's still a good player. I think that people have almost underrated him at this point. He's not what Phoenix needs. It's not a good fit, but that has nothing to do with him sort of being diminished skill-wise. I mean, he's still putting up 18 a game. I think with a bigger role, he could average 20 to 25 still. He's still super efficient. He's been 50, 40, 80 since he got to Phoenix. Like, he's still a good shot creator. He still competes at times defensively, you know, not consistently, but he's able to if he's willing. And he can still create a little bit for others. He's been a willing catch and shoot guy. Like, I still think Beal is the best player that Miami could have gotten back. And I totally understand all the contract concerns, 100%. But I'm just saying that, like, Wiggins also has two more years on his deal after this year, the same that Beal does. And so you're not getting significantly more flexibility. You just maybe $20 million more that you might not have had in cap if you went with Beal, but you get three times as many picks and a better player. And so to me, I think that would have been the better deal for them. I don't know. I feel like that they botched this a little bit. I think that they waited too long where they had no leverage whatsoever. They should have tried to keep it behind closed doors earlier in the year and just maybe trade him in the offseason, trade him earlier in the year before it got so ugly. I don't think they managed as well. I think it was a prideful process where Riley just did not want to send him to Phoenix. And so maybe they took a lesser deal than they could have gotten. But it is what it is. They had no leverage whatsoever once we got down to the night before the trade deadline. So I understand why they pulled the trigger on this to an extent, but I think that they probably could have handled it better with the whole process. And also, I think there probably was a better deal out there for them, but they were so scared off by that contract that it's understandable. I just don't know if it's necessarily the move I would have made, just given, because, I mean, who are they adding in 2026 that's going to push them over the top? That was what they wanted. They wanted that flexibility in 2026. And I don't know who that person is. We'll see. Maybe they'll sign that person and I'll be proven wrong, and because they wouldn't have been able to with Beal there. But, you know, 2 years is not that big of a deal. And you get one more year with Beal, and then he becomes an expiring contract at a huge number that actually could be valuable to some teams looking for cap space in 2027. So, again, probably not what Miami fans wanted to see, or the deal that they thought they might get with Butler, but it's a deal and he's gone, and it's, the situation is over. And so they can just move on, focus on Tyler Hero as the offensive engine for them. The pairing of Ware and Bam, that's looked really good since Ware has been put into the starting lineup, and do their Miami Heat stuff, went in with some undermanned role players like we know that they can. Then we had another deal that the Lakers made aside from the Luka deal, which I'm not going to touch on that on this one. I already gave sort of my reaction to that in my last pod, and I'm sure I'll talk about it more as Luka starts to get integrated into the lineup. But the big question mark for LA was, okay, they don't have any big men now. They have Jackson Hayes, and that's about it on the roster. Christian Coloco that can play the five, basically. Other than that, they got to go small ball. So they needed to add somebody. Even if it was a margin move, they had to add a big just to even stay competitive with opposing bigs down the stretch of the season. So they did not do a margin move, though. They went out and got a pretty big name. Not like he's an all-star or anything, but just someone that I don't think many people thought was even available. They traded for Mark Williams from the Hornets in exchange for Dalton Connect, Cam Reddish, a unprotected 2031 first from the Lakers, and then a 2030 swap from the Lakers as well. So they pretty much exhausted the rest of their first round pick draft capital in terms of being able to trade it. I think they have a couple swaps potentially left, but, you know, this was their move that they wanted to make for the center. And I'll just say, I love this move for them. I immediately was like, wow, I am starting to think LA could really, really contend this season. But again, I love that they didn't just go at a Clint Capella, you know what I mean? Give out some seconds and just ride it out. And, you know, at least we got a body. But Mark Williams is 23 years old. He's still super young. He has 2 years left on his rookie deal, including this year. He's going to make $4 million this year, $6 million next year. So he's incredibly young. He's incredibly cheap. The funny thing is that he's actually younger than Dalton Connect, who's a rookie. So this is a long-term play. I get that they gave up a lot. A pick and a swap is quite a bit for a guy who's been very injury prone, has been inconsistent a bit on the defensive end, and hasn't played meaningful basketball in his NBA career. But he's extremely talented. extremely talented. And I just think that if they can get the best version of him and continue to develop him, I mean, he could be with the team for 5-10 more years. You know, this is an investment in a pairing next to Luka that we've seen the blueprint for with a Derek Lively and a Daniel Gafford. And so I think it's a beautiful fit for them, especially offensively, because Mark Williams, he is good at all the things that Derek Lively's good at. And Derek Lively was just a great fit with Luka as a lob threat. He's going to be the new version of that for Luka in LA. And he's nearly as young, but I actually think he's got a little bit more offensive skills right now, at least. I mean, he's up to 15 a game this season. He's been playing great over the last month or so. And look, he's an athletic freak. He's a legit 7 feet. He is a great lob threat, which is exactly what you want next to Luka and LeBron for that much as well. And he has, I believe I saw he's got the tallest standing reach in the NBA, even more so than Wemby. I think 9'9" is his standing reach. So he's long, he's got length, he's athletic. And so just a perfect fit offensively for this group. I think there's a couple question marks about it, this move, obviously. One being that the guy hasn't been able to stay on the court. It's his third season in the NBA, and he's only played 83 total games, which is obviously the one less than number of games in a full season. So he played 43 as a rookie, only 19 last year, only 23 this year. It took him a while to get on the court this season. So durability is absolutely a question mark here. But I think the reason I'm less concerned about it is because he's so young. I mean, like, if they had traded for Mitchell Robinson, who's what, maybe 3 years older than him, and the same injury history, I would feel it would be absurd for them to do that trade for this type of value and return. But the point is, like, he's so young that he's going to have some healthy years. Like, there just aren't players, unless they have like a career altering injury, that just can't make it to 50 games one time in their career. It just doesn't really happen. So because this is an investment and something, and they're going to have this guy for 5 to 7 years, I'm less scared off by the injury history. If this was a win now move, I'd be like, why are you trading for a dude who can't stay on the court? But again, this is going to help them this year, but it's also a long-term play. So I don't mind it that much from the durability perspective, but obviously, like, it's something to be monitoring, especially for a guy who hasn't played in any high level games to this point in his career. But the other question mark is defensively. He's been very so-so, I'd say, on that end, but it is interesting because he hasn't played great on defense in Charlotte, but the tools are there. I mean, as I said, biggest standing reach in the NBA. He's a freak athlete. He's pretty mobile. He's got good footwork across the board. Like, on paper, he should be a good defender. He's been a good shot blocker throughout his career, even going back to Duke. He was very good in college as a rim protector. So I think this is a similar move to what the Mavs did last year with PJ Washington. They identified a young player that had the tools and the talent to thrive on a contender and a contributing role. But it was more in theory. People last year, when they traded for PJ Washington, they said, look, he's played some small ball five. He, in theory, could be a good stretch four. In theory, could be a good three and D defender on the wing. But in reality, he hadn't really done a lot of that in Charlotte. It was more like he looked like he could be a good defender, but the stats didn't back it up. And so I think this is a similar scenario. I think that when you're playing like meaningful games with Luka Doncic and LeBron James, it's a little easier to give full effort than it is when you're playing with Miles Bridges and LaMelo Ball in a untelevised Tuesday night game in February. You know what I mean? So I think the extra motivation there, I think he's going to be around people that are going to push him to get the best version out of him. So I anticipate him kind of touching into that untapped defensive potential, which he certainly has. I think he's very capable of being not only good on that end, but like really good. And so I love this move for LA. I think it's, I mean, he's kind of like the perfect player to add just because he fits Luka's timeline. He fits the skill set they want offensively, and he's at least got the defensive potential to be very impactful on that end, which is honestly what they need. So, but with that said, on the Hornets side of things, I have mixed feelings on this because, look, in theory, is this good value? Sure. I mean, yeah, an unprotected first, 7 years down the line. I mean, even then, Luka's going to be 32. There's a chance he's not on the team by then. And if he is, he might be a compromised version of himself. So that pick could be valuable down the road, but it's less valuable than it was a week ago. I'll say that. And then the same with the 2030 swap. So this could turn into two good picks for a guy who has played 83 career games and is a questionable defender. So in theory, in a vacuum, sure, decent deal for Charlotte. But I don't love it for them just because what's their plan here? I get they're trying to hoard assets, and I totally get selling off players. You want to trade Miles Bridges? I am all for it. When they traded Rozier and Hayward last year, all for it. But why are you trading a 23-year-old 7-footer averaging 15 and 10, shooting 60% from the field, who has playing the best basketball of his life right now? It's just like, why? I don't know. It just sends mixed messages. You're like rebuilding the rebuild. Like, how much younger of a player can you get than a 23-year-old who's doing the things that he's doing? And so it just, they don't have a replacement waiting for him. They added Nurkic to back him up. So I'll get to that later, but I don't know. I'm not a fan of trading guys on their rookie deals who have outperformed their rookie deal, unless you're getting like a star player back. To just do it for picks to get assets, I'm not a huge fan. I don't know what kind of message this sends to LaMelo Ball, for example. I was really excited at the prospects of a Cooper Flagg ending up in Charlotte. I thought the core of him, Mark Williams, Brandon Miller, and LaMelo could be a really long-term, nice foursome that the skill sets all really fit well together. But now it's like, I'm less excited because they're trading off. Who's to say that LaMelo won't get dealt in the next year or two then? I mean, anyone should be on the table just given that they would trade somebody so cheap, so young, and so good. So yeah, I get it in a vacuum, but it seems like they are more concerned about hoarding assets than actually having some sort of semblance of a respectable team, which for how long they've been sort of rebuilding this, you know, I didn't think they were that far off from making noise. If they got lucky and got a Cooper Flagg, then add some sort of defensive veteran at the forward spot next to him, that's a pretty good starting five that I think could compete next year. But, you know, they seem to be kicking the can down the road, and that's a strategy, but I don't know if I would be happy about it if I was a Hornets fan personally. Then the Milwaukee Bucks made a pretty big deal acquiring Kyle Kuzma, Jericho Sims, and a second round pick in exchange for Chris Middleton, AJ Johnson, and a 2028 first round swap going to Washington. As part of this deal as well, the Knicks get DeLon Wright and the Spurs get Patrick Baldwin Jr. So it's no secret that the Bucks have been trying to move Middleton and some other assets to try to upgrade, as well as to try to get under the second apron, which this deal did accomplish that. So they are now no longer a second apron team. Helps them a lot with flexibility. Their draft picks don't get frozen down the line. They can aggregate salaries again. So this helps them in a number of ways besides just what they think it can do for them on the court. But this, to me, is the only real benefit of this is the apron part of it, because I do not like this trade for them as a on the court decision, because no exaggeration, I think Kyle Kuzma has been the single worst player in the NBA this season. When you take into account just the volume and the usage and what he's done production-wise, he's been awful. Awful, awful, awful. I'm sure people haven't watched a lot of Wizards games this year, and I don't blame you, but Kuzma was a sight for sore eyes, to say the least. I mean, he's averaging the lowest points per game since he was with the Lakers in a part-time starting role. He has 42% from the field, 28% from three, and 60% from the free throw line splits this season, which are all three of those are awful. I mean, the free throw thing especially, I'm like, what happened there? He's averaging nearly a 1-to-1 assist to turnover ratio, with the lowest assists since he had an expanded role getting to Washington. He has a 93 offensive rating and a 120 defensive rating. So he's been just awful on both ends, a minus 27 net rating. Got to be up there for worse in the league. I didn't check, but I can't imagine there's a lot of other guys with actual big minutes that have that big of a gap there. I saw something that when he's on the court, they're outscored by like 17 points per 100 possessions. And then when he's off the court, it's only minus nine or something like that. So when he is on the court, they've been like one of the worst teams in the history of the league. He has a 48.8% true shooting percentage, which is a full 10 percentage points below league average, just about. He has minus 1.3 win shares, which is dead last in the NBA. It's very difficult to be that in the negatives for win shares. So he's just been awful. I mean, there's no way around it. He's been terrible this season offensively. His shot selection is a mess. He can't make shots. He's not a good shooter for his career overall, really. And on the defensive end, he's shown zero effort or interest in competing on that end of the court. So to give up Chris Middleton, who, by the way, he's a better player than Kuzma, even in his compromised version. I get it. He's played only 23 games this year, 55 last year, 33 the year before that, and he hasn't managed to play 30 minutes a game since 2022, but before he had that serious injury that kind of has derailed his career. But even with that and the ankle issues, he's a better player. I'd rather have 24 minutes a game of this version of Middleton than whatever they're going to get out of Kuzma, because Middleton, although compromised, has still been he's still a pretty good ball handler, shot creator. He can initiate some pick and rolls. He's still efficient. I know he's lost a huge step defensively, but it's not like Kuzma is any better on that end. So I don't know what Kuzma brings to this team that Middleton wasn't already bringing a much better version of, outside of just size and length, I guess. I think Kuzma maybe gives them a little bit more flexibility lineup wise. They can play him at the four and move Giannis to the five, which I have been an advocate for. I was tweeting about this last week about how I think they'd be smart to try more Giannis at the 5 minutes and maybe start to move away from Brooke Lopez, dangle him as a trade asset. But I meant that in the way where they could then go add some defensive-minded wing players, not a guy like Kuzma who doesn't even think about defense and also is just a black hole mess offensively. So I get that we've seen a version of Kuzma that can thrive in a diminished role in LA. I mean, he was very good the year they won the championship as a good cutter. His shooting percentages were way higher back then. He was better with his shot selection, did more of the little things. He did compete defensively. Like, we've seen him try and be engaged and be decent there. But that was 5 years ago, whatever it's been at this point. Like, it's been half a decade since we've seen him play a single meaningful basketball game. And I'm not sure when you build up bad habits for that long, if you're going to be able to just toss him aside and go back to what he was doing when he was bought into winning product in LA. So to swap Middleton for Kuzma alone, I don't love. But then when you throw in that they had to give up their 2028 swap, which could be a super valuable pick down the line, as well as AJ Johnson, who was the 23rd overall pick in this year's draft. So they basically gave up two firsts in this deal. Like, AJ Johnson hasn't played much, but he was known to be a very raw prospect. That's a whole other issue about why they even bothered taking him. But that's essentially two first plus Middleton for Kuzma. So I just, value wise, I don't get this trade at all. On the court, fit and product wise, again, I don't really get this trade for Milwaukee. And I think a big problem with Milwaukee and why this deal looks even worse because of the AJ Johnson inclusion in this is they've drafted terribly. I still think that the Dame move is a move that you make. I don't think that was a bad move. The Jrue Holiday version of this team seemed to have stagnated, reached a ceiling. Not sure they were going to be able to get back to what they did in 2021 and get back to winning championships. So I get pivoting to Dame. It made sense to me. They needed a little bit more infusion of offense and shot creation on that end. But the problem is they haven't been able to build the pieces around it. And so just looking back at their recent draft picks, 2024, AJ Johnson, 23rd overall, who is known to be an extremely raw project prospect. They could have drafted Ryan Dunn, who would have fit perfectly into this team. There are other options out there that just made so much more sense than drafting a guy like him. They trade him and give up on him already. They get a similarly raw prospect in Tyler Smith in the second round as well, who has not been able to crack the rotation. 2023, they don't even have a first round pick. And then they pick Chris Livingston at 58 overall, who hasn't panned out into anything. 2022, the 24th overall pick, they take Marjon Beauchamp, who, one, they just shipped out again for Kevin Porter Jr., which KPJ, not a big fan of, but they've already given up on him. They weren't going to re-sign him. They've been looking to move Beauchamp this whole time. But another raw prospect, a guy who played in G League Ignite and just didn't have a shot that was developed, not consistently competing defensively, like a raw guy who just didn't pan out. 2021, they had no first-round pick. They trade away their second-round pick. 2020, they draft RJ Hampton, trade him away in the Drew Holiday trade, get Jordan Nora in the second round, who gave some okay minutes at times, but didn't pan out into anything more than a fringe rotation player. 2019, they trade away the 30th overall pick. And then 2018 is as far as you have to go back to find the last time they made a good, meaningful pick, which is when they drafted Dante DiVincenzo, 17th overall, which, yeah, good pick. Except when you consider the fact that they later traded him away for 35 games they got out of Serge Ibaka. So a washed up end of his career, not even in the rotation, Serge Ibaka is what they got in return for Dante DiVincenzo. So the only good draft pick they've made in 6 years, they dumped for nothing. Then even just going further back, 2017, DJ Wilson, 17th overall. That didn't pan out. 2016, Thon Maker at 10 overall. That didn't work out. They do get Malcolm Brogdon, 36th overall in that draft. So good pick there, except they let him walk in restricted free agency. So since they've had Giannis, they legitimately have made two good picks in 12 years, maybe. One, they let walk in free agency. One, they dumped for 35 games of a washed up big man. So that's why this team has struggled. And that this trade is sort of just like a nutshell of their lack of ability to identify young talent and develop players. They're forced to trade picks because they can't make picks. And then they're just backed into a corner because they can't figure out any rotations on this team. And then the other part of this for Milwaukee, I'm like, Chris Middleton is a legend. He won you a championship as the number two option. Him and Giannis were the longest standing teammates outside of Steph and Draymond. Like, to trade away a team legend, essentially two first round picks for a downgrade, I don't see it. I'm not loving this for Milwaukee even a little bit. And I wouldn't have made this deal. I would have probably tried to see if I could have shot Brook Lopez for some better wings, move Giannis to the five. And I think Lopez would have had some legitimate value on the open market, but we will see what happens. Next, we have Brandon Ingram going to Toronto from New Orleans. It's been rumored for a very long time that he was going to be dealt. Finally was to the Raptors in exchange for Bruce Brown, Kelly Olynyk, a 2026 first-round pick from Indiana that they got in the Siakam trade, and then a 2031 second-round pick from Toronto. So I don't understand this deal. I don't. And listen, this is coming from someone who is, I'm a bit of a Brandon Ingram apologist. I like Brandon Ingram a lot. I think he is underrated. I think that he has gotten unfair criticism to an extent. And I think people have written him off as a guy that just can't contribute to winning. But I watched him back in the 2022 playoffs average like 27 points a game as a legitimate first scoring option. And he put fear in the Phoenix Suns in that series. I know they didn't win, but he was a high level scorer in a very intense playoff environment. And I just think he's underrated. He's a good passer, a good playmaker, one of the better, if not one of the best passers for his position in the NBA right now at the forward spot. He's not always a willing three-point shooter as a catch-and-shoot spot-up guy, but he's still a pretty good shooter. He's at worst league average, a little bit above average shooter. He can create his own shot in the mid-range, and he doesn't always compete super well defensively, but I think it's been hard for him to do so when the team hasn't been super consistent all the time, and they've had him in a weird fit with a lot of other forwards in a crowded front court in New Orleans. So all of that to say, I like Brandon Ingram, and I thought a lot of teams should have jumped at the opportunity to get him for cheap. But the reason I hate this deal is because Toronto is not one of those teams. I don't understand why they would add him to their current roster. And this is now three consecutive deadlines where they have traded away a first round pick. In 2023, they trade away their 24 firsts for Jakob Poeltl, which ended up being the number 8 overall pick in this past year's draft. But the point is, look, they got Poeltl. They wanted a competent center. You could have just drafted one. You know who was available at number 8? Khalil Ware was available. Zach Edey was available. Klingon went 7. So if you really wanted him, maybe you could have moved up a spot. Like, that is a terrible trade. To get a league average at best not dynamic, offensively limited center, given where they are for the number 8 overall pick in the draft, is just, that's bad value and bad management. Then you go to last year. They get Kelly Olynyk and Agbaji for Otto Porter Jr., Kira Lewis, and the 29th overall pick in last year's draft, which, you know, 29th overall pick, short. That one's maybe a little bit understandable. Isaiah Collier got picked. It wasn't a super deep draft anyway. So this one's a little bit more defendable because in theory you could say, well, we like Agbaji better than anybody at the 29th pick, which he's been pretty decent this year. So I understand some of the thought process there. However, when this becomes a trend over 3 years now, and then they trade a first this year for Ingram, that's when it starts to get frustrating because, look, they've now traded 3 first-round picks for Ingram, who, by the way, they probably could have just signed in free agency in the offseason, Jakob Poeltl and Agbaji, because Olynyk went out in this deal as well. So they basically have traded a first for 3 players, one of which maybe in his best season, a fringe all-star, probably a step below that. The other two, not even close to that. So I don't understand what Toronto is doing. They are 16-35. They have the 5th best lottery odds in the NBA right now. And I know that this first round pick was not theirs. It's Indiana, so they can still tank, do whatever. But they should be hoarding as many assets as possible. They should be trying to identify young players, develop those players, and do a rebuild in an old-fashioned way. Because they had a team with Siakam, Anunoby, Fred VanVleet, Gary Trent that they sold off, got rid of, and have essentially built the same version of that team. Like, I don't get it. Like, if you wanted to add Ingram, why not just keep Siakam? If you were going to add RJ Barrett, why not just keep Fred VanVleet? You know, it's just like they got a little bit younger, I guess. It's just with some of those swaps, but it's like they are just continuing to try to be mediocre. And to me, they should be bottoming out and trying to, like, they could get Cooper Flagg. What happens if you draft Cooper Flagg and now you've got Scottie Barnes, Brandon Ingram, and Flagg? Like, their team doesn't make sense fit-wise either. They don't have enough shooting. They've got a million forwards, one competent guard, and one competent pick. And so I just don't know what their goal is. I don't know if they're trying to be bad. I don't know if they're trying to go for the playoffs because they keep making decisions in the middle. And to be honest, since the Kawhi trade and making and winning the finals in 2019, Masai, I think he's lost his fastball. Every move, it seems to make no sense, where they have a really good bounce back year after 2019. And then you're sitting there like, oh, okay, they actually are still really good. So then they keep going for it. But then year after year, you see, okay, maybe this team overachieves and they're not quite as good as we think. They start to sell some pieces off, but then they let Fred VanVleet walk for nothing when they could have traded him. They let Gary Trent walk for nothing when they could have traded him. They trade Siakam for picks that they end up just repurposing those picks to trade for Ingram, who's about as good as Siakam, maybe a little bit worse. They trade away their own picks to get Poeltl. Like, there's no sense of direction here. So I don't know why, of all teams to go get Ingram, Toronto made the least sense for me. But regardless, New Orleans, this trade is fine. I mean, they get a first round pick for Ingram. I'm not sure they could have done better. As I mentioned, I'm a Ingram defender, but it's no secret that his value wasn't super high. They waited to the last possible minute. He's going to be free agent. Someone's going to have to pay him. So it was always either a rental or a guy that you're going to have to give a big deal to. So I understand from their perspective that a first round pick is probably the best they could have done. But I kind of wish that they had done this earlier. I get why they don't want to pay him. But so overall for New Orleans, this is fine. Bruce Brown's an expiring deal. They'll have some more cap space. But they got to figure out what they want to do too. Because are they just going to roll with what they got next year? DeJounte Murray is going to be out for probably all of next season with the Achilles injury. McCollum is getting up there in age, but still can play. I mean, he's still pretty good, but are they going to trade him? They're obviously kind of handing the keys over to Trey Murphy. He's had a really good year. Zion's played a little bit better and been on the court a little bit more consistently over the last few weeks. So I'm not sure what their move is, but overall this deal was just a head scratcher for me on the Toronto side, but I guess New Orleans did pretty well overall. Okay, moving to the DeAndre Hunter deal to Cleveland. And the Cavs got Hunter, and the Hawks got Caris LeVert, Georges Niang, 2029, and 2031 second round picks from Cleveland, as well as a pick swap in 2026 and a pick swap in 2028. But I will say that those pick swaps are double swaps. So Utah has first dibs on the swap. So it'll be the second best between Utah, Cleveland, and Atlanta. So it's not as valuable as a typical swap. We've seen teams start to do this a little bit more over the years. So Atlanta also made another deal. So I'll start with Cleveland, and then I'll get into Atlanta's view overall and sort of the two deals they made. But I think this is a good deal for Cleveland. I mean, DeAndre Hunter's having by far his best year as a pro. I was never a huge DeAndre Hunter fan, but I mean, he's certainly turned his shooting around. And he's been a legitimate piece, honestly, for Atlanta this year. Posting career high 19 a game, 39% from three. So he's been a really good floor spacer. He's been able to do a little bit as a shot creator and ball handler for them. But I think this is just a better fit for Cleveland than LeVert, for example. He's got size. He's 6'8". And they had lacked size at that small forward position between Strus, who's really more of a guard or an undersized forward, if anything. LeVert, again, more of a guard, ball handler type guy. Okoro, he's like plays more like a forward, but he's still 6'5", too. So they really had no size at that position, given the fact that you've got Mitchell and Garland, two kind of undersized guards already playing on the court. Just felt like they needed to get a little bit more length and size at that position. But, you know, this deal, the price was low, seconds and some swaps that may not even come to fruition. So I get why they made it, but to me, Hunter's not really a needle mover. He, again, is having a career year, but in the past has been an inconsistent shooter at times. He's, despite having length, he hasn't really been a good defender. Another guy that's like an in-theory defender coming out of college, he was viewed as like a potential 3-and-D guy, but the D hasn't really been there. The fact of the matter is he hasn't been a good defender. So maybe he's more engaged in Cleveland. They've got a good defensive infrastructure there with Allen and Mobley, and the team is really good. And so it's a lot easier to buy in and compete on that end when the team is winning and they've already built the sort of winning culture there. So I think he'll probably be better on defense than he's been in the past. And I think overall, it's a pretty good pickup, especially considering the value. I like that Cleveland made a move rather than standing pat. I think it would have been easy for them, just given their success this season, to kind of stay where they're at and see how it plays out. But I like that they added somebody. I think this deal was worthwhile for them, but it didn't change my opinion of Cleveland overall. You know, I'm not like feeling better about their chances against Boston than I would have, or New York, or anyone like that. I still think they're fully in the mix in the East, but they're going to have to prove it in the playoffs. And I'm not sure DeAndre Hunter is a needle mover for being able to do that. Then the Hawks made another deal with the Clippers, in which they sent out Bogdan Bogdanovic to LA. They also sent out 3 second-round picks, one in 2025 for Minnesota, one in 2026 for Memphis, and then one in 2027, which was actually the Clippers pick going back to them. So 3 seconds and Bogdan to the Clippers, and the Hawks received Bones Highland and Terrence Mann. And so I love this for the Clippers. I mean, Mann was kind of spotty in and out of the rotation this year. He's gotten some DMPs, coach's decision, at times this season. And Bones Highland, obviously, completely out of the rotation. He's proven to be just he's talented, but a huge head case. Just two stops, same issues across the board. Doesn't compete defensively. Can be explosive on offense at times, but not worth putting out there. So, two expendable pieces. And I think Bogdan is just an awesome addition for LA because they've been awesome defensively. They have been super, super competitive and just annoying to play on the defensive end of the court this season. And offensively, they've been, you know, they struggled at times. They don't have a lot of creators. I mean, especially before Kawhi came back, it was really just James Harden and then Norman Powell, who's just been better than you ever could have expected in an expanded role this season. But they're kind of missing what Powell brought before. Back in years past when they had Paul George, Norman Powell was the off the bench, do some creating and get some shots from deep and put some points up on the board when the stars sat. But now that Powell's been vaulted into the starting lineup and he's taking on some of that responsibility with that unit, now they don't really have that off the bench. Kevin Porter Jr. had been that guy for them this season, but mixed results, I'll say. Not a big KPJ guy, not sure. I loved the minutes he was giving them because he doesn't compete defensively and he's really inefficient and spotty shot selection for them. But Bogdan, I think, is a huge upgrade in that role. I know he's having a very down year, like very down, like the worst of his career to this point. But I still think he has it in him to turn it around. He's been a very consistent shooter throughout his career. He's an underrated shot creator. He can run a little bit of pick and roll. He can go get a look for himself. Like, I just think that he's going to save them in some of those bench minutes where they've really struggled without Harden on the court offensively. So I love this deal. And then the Clippers get 3 seconds as well. I'm not really sure how they were able to finagle that one. I think they're getting the best player in the deal and the picks in the deal. So huge win for the Clippers. I think this was a nice margin move. And I think that they're a pretty legit team, to be honest with you. I was really skeptical on them coming into the year. And even to start the year, I thought it was nice story, yeah, but they'll fizzle out. But with Kawhi coming back, if they get a full healthy version of him at some point, I think they're legit. I think there's a case to be made that this team could win a playoff series, even go as far as the conference finals if the bracket broke their way, depending on who they end up drawing in the postseason. But they made a nice addition here in getting Bogdanović, in my opinion. But on the Hawks side of things, I don't fully get their two moves, to be honest. I mean, you'd think that they're sellers, trading away Hunter and Bogdanović for LeVert, Niang, Mann. And like net overall, they didn't gain any second round picks because they gave 3 to the Clippers, got 3 back from Cleveland. So a couple bad first round swaps and downgrades player wise is really all they got in totality here. And the Hawks, their 2025 pick this season is owed to San Antonio unprotected. Their first round pick next year in 2026, San Antonio has full unprotected swap rights on that. And then they owe their 2027 pick fully unprotected to San Antonio as well. So they don't control any of their draft picks over the next 3 seasons, which means they have no incentive to be bad. They have no incentive to tank. And Jalen Johnson's already out for the season. They traded away 2 of their key rotation players for downgrades. So I'm not sure what they're doing here. I mean, I've been as high on the Hawks as anybody coming into this season and really over the last few years. I love the Dyson Daniels addition. I'm a huge Jalen Johnson guy. I think Okongwu has been awesome since he's been able to get some more of the minutes from Capella this season. And I still remain a Trae Young defender. I still think that he has a super valuable skill set and controls the game, unlike most players are able to in the NBA today. But this just felt like they intentionally got worse. And for a team that doesn't control their draft picks for the next 3 years, it just feels like that's a risky strategy because, again, they're just going to be handing over top 10 picks to San Antonio in the next few years. And so I would have liked if they maybe went and got a Brandon Ingram. I understand if they don't want to dish out picks because they're not really in a place to be doing that given their situation, but they did get some picks from New Orleans in the DeJounte Murray trade. So it's not like they only have their own picks. They have other picks to work with. So I don't know. I would have preferred that they stood pat and just kind of see where they end up at the end of the year and then reevaluate how they want to potentially retool around Trey. I liked what they had when they were fully healthy. I thought they were a team that could make the playoffs. I feel less certain about that now, given the injuries and these moves. I also wonder what their strategy is with Trey. Does this mean he's going to start to become available in the offseason if they're trading away guys? I know there's been reports this week from, I believe Chris Haynes was saying that Trey is getting frustrated because he wants to win, and it felt like they were sellers at the deadline. So I don't know. I don't know what their plan is, but it felt like not win now moves for a team that can't afford to not win now. Next, we have Phoenix, which a lot of trade discussion from them. And the only trade they ended up making was getting off Yusuf Nurkic's contract. They trade him away to Charlotte, where he'll get the starting gig now. Not a lot of centers to compete with there, but they trade him with a 2026 first round pick, which is highly swappable with, I believe, Washington and Memphis. So that pick is very likely to be in the 20s. So not a super valuable first that they give up, but trading that pick to Charlotte with Nurkic for Cody Martin, Micic, and the 2026 second round pick, I believe, coming from Denver. So all in all, if it's a late first round pick in 2026 and they're getting a second in 2026. They kind of just moved back. You know, it's a trade back to get off Nurkic's deal for some maybe lesser players and Martin and Micic. But again, not much to say about this deal other than, okay, Phoenix got off Nurkic's deal. Charlotte continues to try to accumulate draft assets, so it makes sense. But I want to talk more so about Phoenix as a whole and all the Kevin Durant stuff that happened. And there was rumors he was going to go Golden State. And then suddenly there was rumors that maybe they would trade him for Jimmy Butler, either to Miami or to the Warriors. Apparently he did not want to go to the Warriors. This was a little bit catching him off guard. He wants to stay in Phoenix, but they were getting deals, so they felt like they had to listen. And so this is all I'm saying. I never thought he was really going to get traded. I think the speculation that he's going to want out because they're not that good is overblown very clearly. I mean, he said he wants to stay in Phoenix, and it was not something he anticipated being in trade talks. And ultimately, I think it was a good decision by them to not trade him, and not because I think Phoenix needs to go for it. I'll just start by saying this, that I think the Suns are in big trouble this season. They have a really tough remaining schedule. They are at 500 right now. They, on paper, could get passed by San Antonio, could get passed by the Warriors. Like, they are not in a good spot to make the playoffs. And as of right now, I would not pick them to make the playoffs. I wouldn't be surprised if they missed the play-in altogether. They are just not a good basketball team this year. They have not played well consistently at all. And so as of now, I just think the entire West got better and they stayed the same. And the same for them is not good. So I think they're going to miss the playoffs. But the reason I think that they shouldn't have traded Durant is because I think that offers will be better in the offseason. I just think that the net would be a lot wider for casting good offers and number of suitors. I know Golden State was interested. Minnesota apparently was interested. Again, not sure how that would even work. They're both second apron teams. It would have been really difficult cap-wise. The Grizzlies were interested. Miami was interested. But none of those teams really scream like great fit in terms of getting returned back to Phoenix. And I think the two teams that make the most sense to trade Durant to are Houston and Oklahoma City, because they both have a ton of picks. Obviously, OKC has like an infinity picks at this point, honestly. Doubt they would want to trade Jalen Williams or Chet, but they've still got some other interesting pieces with Kayson Wallace. Maybe they'd get Hartenstein back, who's obviously a little older, but I'm sure that's a piece Phoenix would like to have, given that they still have Devin Booker and they've had a lot of issues at the center position. Then on Houston, they have Phoenix's pick. So those are super valuable to the Suns. They also have Reed Shepard, who hasn't been able to crack the rotation, but I'm still a big believer in. There's Jabari Smith, who's been hurt and might prove to be kind of the odd man out with Amen Thompson's ascension this season. So he could become expendable potentially. Cam Whitmore, Tari Eason, and they've got a lot of young guys that could be intriguing to Phoenix. So, but I don't think either of those teams are interested right now, because they have been very successful this season and they might want to ride out what they've got. But the point is, that might change in the offseason. What happens if Oklahoma City fizzles out in the conference finals and falls short for the second year in a row, and Jalen Williams doesn't look up to snuff to be the second option that this team desperately needs? Then they might be much more inclined to say, hey, why don't we just go out and get a certified bucket getter, 25 point per game player in Kevin Durant. It'll be a great sell to the fans, great story, bring him back home and try to go for a championship now. What if Houston loses first round after being one of the best teams in the West all season long to a more experienced, more star heavy team, which to me is very likely this season, I think. They might be way more inclined to be like, okay, we got to add somebody here that is like the guy, the alpha, the offensive go-to scorer that we desperately need. And Durant would fit that bill. So I just think those teams want to see where they're at. If they fall short, they might be more willing to get into those discussions. So to me, I think waiting until the offseason was smart. I didn't love a lot of what Golden State had to offer. I'm not a huge Kuminga guy. I don't really think that that's the building block that teams might think he is. Additionally, they would have to pay him $30 million in the offseason. So he's not even a cheap young option either. And Golden State only had two picks they could trade. So two picks and Kuminga just wasn't going to do it for me. I don't think Miami had much to offer with Butler. I mean, a couple picks, I guess, but that feels like a lateral move if you're not getting a bunch of additional assets next to Butler. I don't know if they'd want to trade Khalil Ware, for example. So we'll see what happens. I would imagine that Durant probably does get traded in the offseason. And I think that's probably the right move because Bradley Beal's basically holding this team hostage. If they can't move him and they don't move Durant or Booker, then they have no means to just improve this roster. And so it feels like Durant is the logical next option. I still think he'd be get a lot of value on the open market. He's still a top 10 player. He's still a 27 point per game score on 50, 40, 80 shooting. Like the guy's still ridiculously good. And they could get a pretty good haul. They're not going to get what they gave out for him, but at least push them in the right direction to try to retool, get a little younger, get a little bigger, get more athleticism, more length to be able to compete with Booker and then whatever they can get back and maybe either repurpose some of those picks, use some of those picks to try to have at least, if you're going to be 500, at least be young and fun. You know what I mean? Don't be old and difficult to watch, which honestly is what they are right now. So. Yeah, that's kind of my take on Phoenix. I think Durant trading in the offseason makes sense for all parties involved. And I think they're going to be able to cast a wider net with more suitors, better offers. So I think it made sense for them to stand pat with not trading Durant. And if Beal's not going to be tradable, then they kind of made their own bet on that one. So the next logical thing is Durant to be moved. And that's going to do it for this episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. Thank you so much for listening. Very exciting to see how all these teams look with their new players, specifically Luke on LA, Fox with the Spurs, Butler with the Warriors. We had a lot of teams that are trying to go all in this year, especially in the Western Conference. So it'll be really fun to see how it plays out. But I do plan on having another pod up over the next week or so, looking to have another guest on. So keep your eyes out for when that does come out over the next week or so. But with that said, thank you so much for listening, and I will chat with you soon.